do not accept that we should engage in open-ended military action without clear direction or accountability.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says Congress needs to assert itself with the Trump administration on its war with Iran. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska Native artists decry an online marketplace's ban on products made from fur.
I really like being able to have my art reach people that in no other way it would have reached.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's time for Congress to assert its authority over the war against Iran.
I do not accept that we should engage in open-ended military action without clear direction or accountability. Congress has a role. Congress has to step up and fulfill that role, that obligation that the Constitution assigns to us.
Murkowski has voted against six Democratic resolutions to immediately end the war. But in a speech on the Senate floor today, she said she plans to introduce an authorization for the use of military force, an AUMF. She says it's both an authorization and a limit.
An AUMF recognizes the reality that the U.S. military is already engaged and provides structure and clarity by requiring the administration to define what we're trying to achieve and the means of achieving it. It requires reporting to Congress, and it brings transparency where little has existed over the past 2 months.
Democrats in Congress have been highly critical of the Trump administration's war strategy. A few Republicans have also raised concerns about the cost and what they say is a lack of information from the administration about the goals. Senator Dan Sullivan raised no such concerns at a hearing today with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Sullivan said he supports the administration's record-high budget request for the military.
Mr. Secretary, I mentioned in the classified hearing today, but I do think the $1.5 trillion top line is historic. It meets the needs.
Sullivan praised the administration for requesting money to modernize Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. He also drew attention to Russian incursions in the north and made a pitch for the Defense Department to lend support to an Alaska natural gas pipeline. He asked no questions about the war, except to point out that the U.S. did not intentionally target civilians in an airstrike that destroyed a school in Iran. Sullivan's office did not immediately respond to an interview request or to say whether he planned to support Murkowski's Iran war authorization. Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed a bipartisan election reform bill this afternoon, setting up a contentious override vote in the coming days. Senate Bill 64 proposed a variety of changes to Alaska's election system, especially around absentee voting. The bill would set up a ballot tracking and curing system, which would allow Alaskans to watch their votes move through the counting process and correct minor errors on absentee ballots. Hundreds of ballots with curable issues, especially on military bases and in rural Alaska, were not counted in the 2024 election. The bill would also speed ballot counting. In a letter to legislators, Dunleavy said he supported many of the reforms and even encouraged lawmakers to model future election bills on the one he vetoed. But Dunleavy said the ballot tracking and curing system couldn't be, quote, responsibly built, tested, and deployed before the November general election. State Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat who worked on the bill, says it's tough news.
It's a broken system, and he had an opportunity to fix it. It's a bipartisan measure. We've worked with very conservative members, worked with his office, and disappointing.
Willikowski said earlier this week he expected that a joint session to override the veto could be convened within a few days. It's unclear whether the bill has enough support, though. It requires 40 votes, and the bill passed by a combined vote of 39-20 with one member absent. Well, the online marketplace Etsy plans to ban products made out of fur, as well as threatened or endangered animals. While many Alaska Native artists say they do not use the platform, several said they were frustrated with the decision. Aliona Niden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Cheyenne Nelson pulls a pair of earrings from a box stacked with her creations.
So these are otter, and I buy my fur from the scraps of other artists so that nothing goes to waste.
Nelson is Aleut and Tlingit, and is an owner of Iliamna Arts, based in Anchorage. She's a self-taught artist and uses fur from otters, rabbits, lynx, and foxes to make jewelry. She also adds agate, shells, and other natural materials she finds on Alaska beaches. She sells her art to customers from California to Chicago and from Canada to the Netherlands. But this might change. Etsy emailed artists like Nelson in early April to notify them it will ban fur products starting August 11 as part of their ongoing biodiversity efforts.
I just like stopped dead in my tracks because it was like the worst case scenario. To have that taken away is such a bummer because I really liked being able to have my art reach people that in no other way it would have reached.
The new Etsy policy says it will apply to fur from animals killed primarily for their pelts, like mink, fox, and rabbit. It says the ban will also pertain to products made from whales, seals, bears, and other threatened and endangered species. The policy says the goal is to protect wildlife from extinction and conserve animals that are most vulnerable. However, it was not clear how the company would establish that animals were killed for fur and not for sustenance, as is often the case for Alaska Native people. There don't appear to be exceptions for indigenous artists whose rights to harvest animals and create traditional crafts are often protected by federal law. Etsy did not respond to emailed questions for this story. Many Alaska Native artists contacted for the story said they don't use Etsy to sell their creations. But Nelson and several others say the new policy will disproportionately harm indigenous artists.
You've ostracized the entire indigenous population that wants to share their art through Etsy.
Nelson says that if Etsy rolled out the policy with meaningful exceptions for indigenous artists, she would have more respect for the decision. She's not sure she wants to continue doing business through Etsy, even though it's a well-established platform that would be hard to compete with. Jamie Newhawk Stallings is Yupik and Athabascan, who now lives in Idaho. She owns a store she named after herself.
Newhawk, it means beauty of the sunset.
Stallings makes earrings, cuspooks, and other clothing using fur and feathers from her family's hunts, like ducks, beavers, and rabbits. Like Nelson, she sells her art at local markets as well as Etsy. Stallings says the Etsy fur ban discriminates against Native artists who rely on fur to make money and treat animals with respect, contrary to what the ban tries to prevent.
Historically, there's been a lot of shame put onto certain parts of our lives, like our language, and now it's fur. We don't disrespect animals whatsoever. In fact, we have the highest regard for animals, and this is our way of cherishing the animal's life.
On Etsy, Stallings often takes custom orders, sometimes to account for customers' allergies, and sometimes to make something unique for special occasions like weddings, anniversaries, and graduations.
I just did one this year that went to Georgia. She messaged me on Etsy and said, can you do a custom order of coyote fur pom-pom earrings, but make them really, really big?
When Stallings was small, she was a part of her father's indigenous dance group, Miracle Drummers and Dancers. She remembers performing in the Anchorage Native Heritage Center to a crowd of tourists from China, Australia, and other countries. Between the performances, she would sit with her mom at a table, selling earrings and talking to guests.
Earrings were the one thing that we were able to share with people. I really love that, being able to connect to people from everywhere. It's unifying.
Stalling says that she originally felt a lot of anger toward Etsy for its new policy. But now, she hopes the ban can motivate indigenous artists to come together and create their own platform that sells traditional art on their terms. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naidin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a nonprofit gets a big, unexpected donation to continue helping families with newborns.
It's an investment in the future of families and their babies.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Last Friday, Anchorage police confirmed 19-year-old Kelly Hunt of Shaktulik was dead after disappearing in January. While she was unaccounted for, two advocates who say the authorities weren't doing enough ran their own investigation and worked to keep Hunt's story in the public eye. As KNOM's Margaret Sutherland reports, a break in the case came the same day a ceremony was held to remember lives impacted by violent crimes.
It's a rainy Monday afternoon. A group of 100 or so gather around a small tree on the park strip in Anchorage for an annual remembrance ceremony.
We will now begin the ribbon hanging portion of our ceremony.
Antonia Comack steps up and hangs a black ribbon, symbolizing a victim of homicide, among many others on the branches. There's no ribbon for 19-year-old Kelly Hunt. Comack, a missing and murdered Indigenous people advocate, has spent the last 3 months investigating her disappearance. Comack doesn't know that Hunt's body was found just a few hours ago. Kelly Hunt graduated from high school in Shaktulik in 2025. She played basketball, liked to dance on TikTok, and was a freshman at Alaska Christian College in Saldatna. The community of Shaktulik held a fundraiser to bring her home for the holidays. After break, she was in Anchorage headed back to school. Around 6 a.m. the morning of January 7th, Hunt left a friend's house where she was staying and never came back. The Anchorage Police Department says Hunt's family reported her missing 4 days later, the day before classes started for the spring semester. The family called Comack that day too. Comack drove in from Wasilla and started digging.
I was immediately worried because her brother told me she left all of her belongings at that house, all of her clothes, and what concerned me the most was there was a large amount of money in her purse. Why would she leave all that money? So I was like, okay, something's wrong here.
Comack says she posted flyers in the neighborhood and spoke with friends and other connections. After about a week, she says the trail went cold. Public attention faded. In March, Shaktulik's basketball team played in the state championship tournament in Anchorage. Fellow MMIP advocate Alexis Savage organized this chant.
I could feel the community forgetting. What needed to happen was something big where, you know, all the attention is on Kelly.
In the stands, her group waved 145 posters with a photo of Hunt in her high school basketball jersey. After that, Savage says she took on the case full time. The last known people to see Hunt alive were her friends in the house where she was staying in Anchorage. They couldn't be reached for an interview with KNOM, but Savage and Comack said they interviewed them multiple times. Comack says she believes Hunt was picked up by somebody that was selling alcohol. Savage added that the friends shared a Snapchat message suggesting she was going to have a few shots with a friend. Savage and Comack got access to Hunt's Snapchat account, but said they couldn't find the messages. Savage said the friends told her the police didn't fully interview them until more than 3 months after Hunt went missing.
That's like the most critical piece, is talking to the last people that she was with. It's like so insane to me.
APD says they did interview the friends earlier on, then called them in for more questions. Because it's an ongoing investigation, the department could not give any specifics on Hunt's case. Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case says he can't share if investigators suspect foul play.
But what I will say is Kelly's story is a very compelling story from start to finish. We struggle with wanting to tell that story and not wanting to tell the story at the same time. And I think it's really important that those that advocate for MMIP understand that we are really struggling with that.
He says APD and advocates are not quite on the same page right now in this case. The chief says in general, when someone is reported missing, they don't automatically treat it like a crime. He says it isn't illegal to be missing, and that limits what his investigators can do. For weeks, Savage and Comack called out APD on Facebook and urged them to do more for Hunt and other MMIP cases. Comack says this also makes her feel unsafe.
That's what it's like to be a Native woman in Alaska. You're scared of law enforcement. You're scared of murderers. You're scared of men. Like, if I go missing or murdered, I'm the one that talks about it in the state of Alaska. Like, who's going to talk about me? It's just, like, constant fear.
A few hours after the remembrance ceremony, Comack learned a body was found a few blocks from where Hunt was staying, and she went.
I'm in the neighbor's yard right now, and she said that this was full of snow this winter. It's just like an empty ravine.
From a high vantage point, she watched the investigators process it like a crime scene, collecting evidence and preparing the body for transport. 5 days later, the authorities publicly confirmed it was Hunt. An autopsy and official cause of death are pending. No arrests have been made. Now, the crime scene unit is long gone, and there's a growing tribute of flowers, crosses, and photos of Hunt by the side of the road. Savage says this isn't the end.
It's the first thing I think of and the last thing I think of at night. My poor husband, he's like, when are you going to come back to reality? And I may never come back.
Comack and Savage say they won't put it down until the case is closed and they can answer, what happened to Kelly Hunt? With reporting from Anchorage, I'm Margaret Sutherland.
The State Department of Fish and Game announced this month that an estimated commercial salmon harvest this year will be about 126 million fish. That's less than two-thirds of what they ended up harvesting last year. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, a biologist who manages the state's commercial fisheries isn't concerned.
Every year, state biologists predict how many salmon can be commercially harvested in relation to expected run strengths. It guides how they manage the state's fisheries, like when and where they open and for how long. This year's expected overall harvest is much smaller than what was expected last year, like nearly 90 million fewer salmon.
It's not particularly concerning to me.
Forrest Bowers heads the state's Division of Commercial Fisheries. He says there is inherent uncertainty in the forecasts.
Keep in mind, this is a projection. You know, the accuracy of the projection varies across the state, particularly for stocks like coho salmon. They are very difficult to forecast. Chum can be difficult to forecast as well.
Still, 90 million fewer salmon than predicted last year? That huge gap mostly boils down to one species, pinks, also known as humpies. Their two-year life cycle is the shortest of all salmon. And for whatever reason, their runs in Alaska are far smaller in even-numbered years. Pinks are the most commercially harvested salmon. Last year, they made up about 61% of the total expected commercial harvest. This year, they make up nearly 44%.
The difference is 64 million fewer pink salmon.
The other salmon species, king, sockeye, chum, and coho, make up another 77 million fish in the expected harvest. The biggest part of that is Bristol Bay's robust sockeye or red salmon fishery. It's the largest sockeye fishery in the world.
Roughly 80% of the sockeye harvest in the state, 80% or more, has been coming from Bristol Bay.
Managers expect a commercial harvest of about 32 million sockeye in that fishery. It's a smaller forecast than recent years, but Bauer says it's still strong compared to the fishery's history. King or Chinook salmon is the most valuable salmon species, and Southeast Alaska accounts for the lion's share of commercial harvests. 166,000 were commercially harvested in the region last year. Bauer says those runs are trending in the right direction. Last year, the Taku River near Juneau had the best king return in over a decade. Still, it remains on the state's Board of Fisheries Stock of Management Concern list, along with the Stikine River, King Salmon River, and Andrew Creek. That means fisheries associated with those waterways are more restricted.
But overall, you know, things are definitely looking better in Southeast Alaska for Chinook than they were, say, 6 or 7 years ago.
Most of Alaska's commercial salmon fisheries run from June through September, depending on the location and the targeted species. Last year's harvests across the state were valued at about $541 million. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
As spring approaches on the YK Delta, so does breakup on the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers. Following a cold winter, forecasters say flooding is likely. KYUK's Samantha Watson reports about how to be prepared and what to know about this breakup season.
Okay, ready for a little bit of science? When it comes to river breakups, there are two different kinds, thermal and dynamic. Thermal breakups happen when the river ice is usually thinner and with a low snowpack. After a warm and sunny April, the ice can weaken more easily and break into smaller pieces. That means better drainage and usually minimal flooding. That's what happened last year when you could see smaller ice chunks floating outside of Bethel. The other kind of breakup, dynamic, that happens when it's colder. There's more snow and stronger ice, which means bigger chunks. That can cause ice jams when breakup occurs. This is when more flooding can happen. Because of this year's cold snap on the YK Delta, forecasters are saying this year's breakup is trending towards the dynamic side. These next few weeks will still play a big role in determining how the ice thaws, but it's likely some flooding will occur. So here are some ways you can prepare. Number one, make a plan.
One of the very first things that you really should do is really talk about a good strategy plan with your family, those, especially for those in your family that need extra help or extra care.
That's Jana Drake. She works with the state's Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. She's also part of the Riverwatch crew that monitors breakup. Drake says, talk to your family about the best way to get out fast if needed and move to a community shelter. A family communication plan, like a sheet of paper with everyone's phone numbers on it, can come in handy. Drake also recommends building an emergency toolkit stocked with fresh water, food, and batteries. She says life straws are also really great to have around. It's also important to gather all medications together, as well as important documents, including passports, insurance and social security cards, tribal IDs, and driver's licenses. Number two, do what you can now. Drake says to move all vehicles and boats to higher ground prior to breakup. If you can, put other household valuables in water-safe containers. If you have pets, it's a good idea to prepare some of their food to grab if you need to move to higher ground. Number three, stay updated. As Drake says, water is the most dangerous element.
Water, it don't play. You know, fire, if a fire comes around, we can put water and it's out. Water, we don't get those privileges. It's going to do what it wants to do, and we have to wait until it is absorbed or retreats.
It's important to stay updated on breakup forecasts and stay ahead of the flooding as much as possible. You can sign up for emailed breakup updates via daily situation reports issued by the state's Emergency Management Department. You can also check the Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center's updated map. You can find links to both of these resources on our website. Faith Clyde works with the Alaska State Emergency Operations Center. She says another impact of the cold winter has been shore ice that's held fast to coastal communities. Their partners at the National Weather Service say it's been a long time since the shore ice has stuck around through breakup.
So what they're expecting is that coastal communities along the Kuskokwim, where the Kuskokwim, the mouth of the Kuskokwim and the mouth of the Yukon, those coastal communities may see flooding in ways that is a result of the shore ice still holding fast as breakup reaches the ocean.
Some of these communities and other villages at risk include those impacted by Halong.
There's a lot of cross planning and a lot of anticipation that some of the communities that were impacted by Halong will also see impacts from Riverwatch. How that looks, you know, no one has a crystal ball and can't quite forecast that, but at least everybody is aware and we're working on trying to mitigate what we can.
She says her department is on heightened awareness for breakup events, and more staff are involved this year across organizations involved in Riverwatch. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
A Kodiak-based nonprofit that supports newborns and their families was recently surprised with a major donation from its financial institution. Heather Priest is the founder of Kodiak Kindness, which provides free infant feeding classes, home visits, and 24-hour phone support to Kodiak area families with newborns. In February, she got a call from the head of Credit Union One.
Then he said, "Are you sitting down?" And he told me that Credit Union One had applied to, had pledged to give Kindness $100,000. And then the Federal Home Loan Bank was going to multiply that by 2.5. And within a week or 2 weeks after that, we got a check in the mail for $350,000.
That's enough to cover nearly 2 years of Kindness's operating costs. Mark Burgess, president and CEO of Credit Union One, said in a press release that Kindness is doing, quote, deeply meaningful work by showing up for parents, children, and communities in moments that matter most, end quote. Kindness has expanded in the last few years, too, most recently hiring 2 new peer counselors in the Northwest Arctic last October. The organization is up to 10 part-time staff members, plus several volunteers spread around Kodiak, Anchorage, and the Northwest Arctic. Priest says it's amazing to see how much Kindness has grown since it split off from Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center as an independent nonprofit in 2021. Since she started the organization in 2006, she says she has experienced several years of financial uncertainty.
Like any organization, there's ebb and flow and fits and starts and some days where we feel like, can we even do this anymore? And are we going to last even another year kind of thing?
There was an extreme ebb when the Trump administration froze more than $1 billion in federal funds going to Alaska last year. More recently, a federal court temporarily blocked Trump's order, allowing the funds to flow again as the underlying lawsuit plays out. But with the recent one-time cash infusion, Jennifer Sheridan, the services coordinator with Kindness, says the nonprofit can grow even more.
We're not going to spend this money on frivolous things. It's an investment in the future of families and their babies.
Priest said Kodiak Kindness's board of directors would be discussing how to spend the $350,000. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Aliona Niden in Anchorage, Margaret Sutherland in Nome, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Samantha Watson in Bethel, and Davis Hovey in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.